So welcome to you all, new friends and old friends. Before I introduce the speaker and the subject of the 14th public lecture at the ITP, I'd like to take this opportunity to bring you up to date on some of the new and exciting events that are happening at the ITP and at UCSB. Of course, most of you have heard about our two new Nobel laureates, our colleagues in physics and engineering, Professor Alan Heger of the physics department, who shared the Nobel Prize in chemistry for his work on conductive polymers, and of course Professor Herbert Kommer of engineering, who shared this year's prize in physics. The other news is that here at the ITP, we are growing in many directions. We have new programs, and we have many more visitors, more scientists, and a lot of excitement. We're planning to expand our activities significantly in at least three areas: astrophysics, mathematical physics, and biophysics. We're running at the moment programs in astrophysics on neutron stars and on high temperature superconductivity, and next year we're running five programs for the first time. In the spring, an innovation for us, a program on statistical physics and biological information. The physicists would like to take over biology, and this is a program on the physics or statistical physics of biological information, how to make sense of the human genome, if you want. The other program is more traditional physics, string theory. And the title of the program is that the frontier of string theory, something called M theory. M stands for mystery, mother, who knows. In the fall, we're running three programs simultaneously, very crowded. One is on the dynamics of neural networks, another experiment in biophysics. From Biophysics to Behavior, it's entitled. The second program is a program on nanoscience, the physics of new nanomaterials, which are becoming very exciting from both a theoretical, an experimental, and technological point of view. And the third program is on quantum information, somewhat related to today's lecture, entanglement, decoherence, and chaos. And despite its title, that's not a reference to the, it's not a study of the American national election system. Now, expanding programs and research the way we're trying to do means that we're going to need more space. We're already running up against our physical limitations, and we're already in the planning phase with Michael Graves, who designed this beautiful building, to extend it, close off the building, create a wonderful space in the courtyard, and give us enough room for all of these new scientific activities. So this is a very exciting time for the ITP, and there are many opportunities for our friends to participate in the growth of the Institute and its unique programs. And to support this leading edge research of theorists who work here. For those of you who might be interested in finding out more about how you can participate with us during this pivotal period of the Institute's growth, please contact our new Director of Development, Dr. Sarah Vaughan, who is sitting, Sarah, stand up, or myself after the lecture for more information. You can also update your mailing list over there on the table where we've put some information about our upcoming programs that might attract your interest, and leave us a note on one of the cards there if you're interested about your interests in the ITP and its activities. We'll certainly continue to keep you informed of our of the development, our attempts at development at the ITP, and of future lectures. For your calendars, the next public lecture is tentatively scheduled at this point for January 31st. 2001. And the speaker will be Melissa Franklin, a professor of physics at Harvard University, who will speak on elementary particle physics. Now let me turn to tonight's lecture. As I said, this is the 14th in our series of public lectures. And before I start, let me remind you that in our tradition is after the lecture's over and you've had a question, had an opportunity to question at length the speaker, you're all encouraged to linger afterwards and join us for a reception in the Commons Room down the hall. The subject of today's talk, lecture, is quantum mechanics. And as you all know, the discovery of quantum mechanics was perhaps the greatest scientific revolution of the 20th century. Quantum mechanics is really provided the basis for our exploration of nature ever since. It actually provides us with the language with which we've been able to formulate the basic laws of nature and understand its working, the workings of matter. Quantum mechanics forced physicists to reshape their ideas of reality, to rethink the nature of things at the deepest level, and to revise their concepts of position and speed, as well as cause and effect. Although quantum mechanics was created to describe an abstract world of atoms far removed from our daily experience, its impact on our everyday life is enormous. The spectacular advances in chemistry, biology, medicine, some of which we now celebrate with Nobel Prizes, and essentially every other science could not have occurred without the tools that quantum mechanics has made available. In fact, without quantum mechanics, there would be no global economy to speak of, because the electronics revolution that has brought us the computer age is a child of quantum mechanics. So is the photonics revolution that has brought us the information age more recently. The creation of quantum mechanics has totally transformed our world, bringing with it all the benefits and risks of a scientific revolution. So although it has affected everyone in his daily life, it has been somewhat harder for the general public to come to grips with the depth of this scientific revolution. This is also true of the inventors of the theory. Niels Bohr, one of the inventors of quantum mechanics, said, "Anyone who is not shocked by quantum theory has not understood it." And Albert Einstein, who made some of the seminal contributions early on to quantum theory, hated it and remarked at one point that if quantum theory is correct, it signifies the end of physics as a science. And even Richard Feynman, whose novel formulation of quantum mechanics will be elucidated by tonight's speaker, said, "I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." Well, that's why we're so lucky to have today someone who does understand quantum mechanics and who will explain it to us. Steve Girvin got his PhD at Princeton University, where I remember him as an excellent student. I think he took my quantum field theory course. Isn't that right? Okay. And is now distinguished professor of physics at Indiana University. He's very well known to the ITP community at Santa Barbara, since he served with great distinction as chair of our advisory board. He was chair, I think, the year that I came, and was of enormous help to me in finding my way and starting some of these new programs that I told you about. Steve is one of the world's leaders in the theory of condensed matter, of solids, of electronic materials. His work focuses on the collective emergent properties which appear when you have large groups of quantum particles interacting coherently together, such as electrons in magnets, or superconductors, or semiconductors. Steve, we're lucky, very lucky to have Steve visiting the ITP for the whole year. And he's one of the crucial participants in the exciting program that we're running this semester on high temperature superconductivity. The title of his talk is Mr. Feynman's Quantum Mechanics, a Field Guide for Curious Characters. Steve?
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, David. Well, gee, that's a lot to live up to, David. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about, when the light comes on here, a little bit about Richard Feynman, the person. He was a very interesting person, and he was a very original thinker, something of a magician. He was famous for just going away and coming back the next day with the answer to some problem sort of pulled out of a hat. And he had ways of thinking about problems that were quite mysterious to ordinary mortals. And also, what I want to do tonight is do some experiments, some demonstrations, which are simple enough that you can do in a high school classroom or in your own home with your kids, and show you that you can actually observe quantum mechanical effects with flashlights and baby powder and mirrors. There's some photos of the demos. In case they don't work out at home, you can look here at this webpage. And if you're interested in reading more, the way I'm going to present the material is really a description of a formulation of quantum mechanics, a version of quantum mechanics. It's a very rich theory, and you can have rather different ways of describing what the particles are doing, which are physically equivalent, even though they look rather different. And Feynman invented one of these ways and described it in this little book written for the general public, QED, Quantum Electrodynamics, The Strange Theory of Light and Matter. Okay. So first, a little bit about Feynman himself. He was from Far Rockaway in Queens, I think. I occasionally say Brooklyn, but I think it's Queens. And when he was actually a student at Princeton, before he even finished his degree, he was drafted to work on the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos. And whenever there was something locked up in a safe and the person who had the combination to the safe was away on business somewhere else, they would call Feynman to come in and open the safe, which you can, doesn't show up very well here, but he's had various magic tricks for opening safes. And he also was famous for signing in every morning, going through the guardhouse, signing in, coming inside, finding a hole in the fence, crawling out, going back, signing in again, keep signing in until the guard would notice. And then they would get very confused on how to deal with this situation. Feynman was famous as a bongo drummer. He lived in Brazil for a while. He took part in plays at Caltech, where he worked most of his life. Was a great storyteller and an interesting character. His autobiography, "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," is fun reading. Feynman, in addition to sort of contributing to mainstream physics, high energy physics, quantum mechanics, condensed matter physics, he also gave a very famous lecture about what has now become the field of micromechanics and microelectronics. And one of the things he did in this lecture is called "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom," is challenge someone to build an electric motor whose dimension was less than 1/64th of an inch on all sides. And here you see that's the head of a pin. That's the motor. And he was very disappointed that someone was able to just go out and do this with no advance in technology, just using existing technology, they were just very good machinists. He was hoping to push back the frontiers. But that lecture really presaged much of the modern developments in micro-miniaturization. Near the end of his career, he served on the commission which was investigating the space shuttle disaster, the Challenger explosion, and the committee was headed by the Secretary of State and had various representatives from NASA and the military on it, but he was the lone scientist, and he wrote a very famous minority report, which appears as an appendix in that report, explaining that you can't make any political compromises with Mother Nature, you can't violate the laws of physics. And he did a very thorough analysis of the whole shuttle program, explaining, for instance, that the software part was extremely good. The software teams would divide up into adversarial groups, and one would write code, and the other would try to find problems with it, and so forth. And other parts were, the engineering was, estimates of the safety were completely off. And then a very famous demonstration about the problem with the rubber O-rings, he took some of the material and clamped it in a C-clamp and dunked it in his drinking water on live television during this report, and showed that after the rubber got cold, it completely lost its elasticity and its ability to seal, which pretty much settled the discussion. So, since I didn't take, I'm probably the only person who got his degree at Princeton that didn't take David's quantum field theory course. I actually learned my quantum mechanics last weekend in Manhattan at the Royal Theater, where there was an extremely good Broadway show called Copenhagen, which was about the very famous meeting in 1941 between Niels Bohr, who was one of the grandfathers of quantum mechanics, and Werner Heisenberg. And the discussion was presumably about the possibility of building an atomic bomb, although it's very uncertain what was actually said at this meeting, and that uncertainty is the topic of this this play, and is tied in with the uncertainty of quantum mechanics that we're going to talk about. Now, this quantum mechanics lecture lasted 2.5 hours and cost me $65. Tonight's lecture is free, and it only lasts an hour, so you're really in much better shape. The other thing that's important to know about Copenhagen is that that's really one of the seats of learning from which quantum mechanics arose. And the great thing about Scandinavia, where I spend a lot of time there, the great thing about this is that they use money from the sale of beer to support quantum mechanics. So this guy, Johan Christian Jacobsen, in 1876, founded the Carlsberg Foundation, which and money from that foundation was what allowed Niels Bohr to establish his very famous Institute for Physics, at which all the foundations of quantum mechanics were laid. And in the Tuborg company is another beer company. They're now the same company. And they use these cartoon characters from Storm Petersen, famous Danish cartoonist from the last century. And with a little help from so this is a copy of this Tuborg beer commercial. It says to this guy, this character, Pericles, can you tell me when Tuborg tastes best? And with a little help from Photoshop, my secretary was able to make it say right after a lecture on quantum mechanics. So that's what you guys can do to recover. Okay. So that was the easy part. Now we have to learn some quantum mechanics. And the first thing we should talk about is classical mechanics, which is the theory of motion and forces and equilibrium and trajectories and velocity in falling bodies that was developed mostly by Galileo and Isaac Newton many, many years ago. So here's an example of classical mechanics, the kind of motion that occurs in everyday life. This is my former friend Jay Inman. He's lying on a bed of nails, and this is a 10-pound sledgehammer. And there's no uncertainty about where that sledgehammer is. You can see it. It's right there. It's moving at a certain speed. And large objects can be described by this classical mechanics. And there's no uncertainty about what their trajectory is or what's going to happen. And there's no uncertainty, for instance, in Jay's mind about whether or not he's going to die. He knows he's going to die during this demonstration. So that's what happens for large objects in everyday life. And the laws of classical mechanics that were developed to describe this are essentially exact, essentially perfect, but they're actually approximations. They're extremely good approximations to the actual laws of physics, and they work extremely well in everyday life with large objects like sledgehammers. But they actually fail for tiny objects, for atoms, for electrons, for photons. Most of tonight's lecture is going to be about photons, which are particles of light. And you may not have known that light was made of particles, but we'll get into that. And one of the things that David alluded to was the very difficult change in worldview that had to occur when quantum mechanics was invented, because some things became unknowable. There were just questions that you could ask and that you couldn't ask about a physical system if it were quantum mechanical. For instance, you might not be able to say precisely where an electron is in a system or where an atom is. It's kind of fuzzy in some sense. You're not exactly sure where it is. And this led to one formulation of quantum mechanics in which you replaced particles by waves, things that were kind of spread out. And in this microscopic world where certain things were unknowable, the act of measurement, the act of finding out what the position of a particle is, could affect the system in a way that you couldn't control or know what it was. And some element of randomness appears. And so people had to completely change the way that they think about the physical reality. And as I said, there are more than one formulation of quantum mechanics. There's a formulation, one of the earliest, due to Schrodinger, in which you say that particles are actually waves. And there's a different formulation, which the one I'm going to talk about tonight, due to Feynman, it says, no, particles are particles, but they do very strange things, and they take very strange paths that you don't really expect. So we're going to try to explore that and understand that particular version of quantum mechanics. So it's going to be a talk about very light particles of light, in fact, and these photons. And I first have to convince you that light is made of particles. Light is made of particles that carry lumps or discrete quanta of energy. And those lumps of energy are called photons. And we can find those lumps of energy because they're able to have an effect on a piece of metal. They're able to liberate an electron from the metal and transfer its energy from the photon to the electron. The photon disappears in that process. So here's a thought experiment. You take a light bulb. You turn it on like a flashlight bulb. There's about 10 to the 18 photons per second. That's a one with 18 zeros after it. Lots and lots of photons per second coming out. So many that it's very hard to notice that there are individual particles. It's like you live in a house with a tin roof and it's lots of small raindrops, or a few large hailstones, you could tell the difference, right? But if there are lots and lots of raindrops, it can sound almost continuous. So we want to deal with one photon at a time, so we'll put in lots of neutral density filters to absorb most of the particles, and then we'll just have a very low intensity of photons coming out here. And you can actually have such a low intensity that their average distance between the particles, if you let the beam go straight, is 2 kilometers, a mile and a quarter. Okay? That's actually still quite a few photons per second because the speed of light is so high. But they're very, very far apart. Okay? Then you hit this special thing called a photomultiplier tube. It's got some metal here, and there's some electrical voltages on these pieces of metal. And the energy of this particle of light can liberate an electron, which then goes flying up and crashes into this piece of metal and gives so much energy that it liberates many electrons, and you multiply and multiply, and you end up with perhaps 1 million electrons, a big pulse of electricity going here, and you can put that into an audio amplifier, stereo amplifier, and hear a click. So waves do not behave this way. If light were just waves, the energy would just kind of arrive smoothly and gradually, and nothing would happen. You would not hear individual discrete clicks of this, what's essentially a Geiger counter here. So instead of putting the signal into an amplifier and listening to it, you can use a digital camera to take a picture of it. So here is an experiment, again, from Lyman Page's group at Princeton. And here is the result of looking with this camera at this light bulb through this very thick set of filters to make it a very dim light. And after an exposure of 1/30th of a second, 3 photons have arrived. One hit there, one hit there, one hit there. I mean, it's clear that they are discrete events, right? It's not just kind of gradually getting more and more gray. And if you did the experiment over again, it might hit here, or here, or here. It's random. There's no way to predict. It's unknowable where they're going to land. It's random, okay? After an exposure of 1 second, some more particles have landed, and you say, well, maybe it's not quite random. It looks like there's a slightly larger probability of landing in certain places because there are more dots there. And after 100 seconds, it becomes very clear that there's some sort of pattern here, that the photons are arriving at random places, but the probability of it happening is larger here and here and here than it is in between. Okay? So it's not completely random. But it's very clear from this demonstration that light is made of particles that arrive at random locations in the beam. Okay? Well, let's pretend that it's the, I started to say the last century, but the one before last, the 19th century, and just we're classical physicists, and we'll make a very simple model of how these particles move. They're just particles of light. They move in straight lines at the speed of light, some very fast speed. And that model, that approximation to the world, is that classical model is called geometric optics. So you're familiar with all of this because this is how things operate in everyday life. If you don't look too closely, you have a light bulb, you have a surface, you put a little thing there to block some of the light, it casts a shadow, right? And it's perfectly consistent with the light just moving along in straight lines and hitting here, and if it hits there, it doesn't continue. So that's very familiar to all of us, okay? Also, you would say that if light is made of particles, then when light bounces off a mirror, it should be just like a billiard ball bouncing off the side of a billiard table. When it, if you have a detector here, then the light will come in at a certain angle relative to the surface, and it will bounce off with exactly the same angle. The angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incidence, just like it does for billiard balls. And So that would be perfectly sensible, and in fact, that's pretty much what happens. That model, that approximation to the real world works very well in most cases. But there's something immediately worrisome about this classical picture. And the first problem is one that you're familiar with, although you may not realize it, and that's partial reflection. If I have a source of light and a piece of glass, then the particles of light come out, and about 96% out of 100 will go through, and about 4 out of 100 on average will reflect. So if you look like through a plate glass window at night when your living room is brightly lit and it's dark outside, you can see a reflection of your face perhaps as it's lit, and there's no light from the outside coming in to obscure that. Or in these things for day and night on your rearview mirrors in your car, there's a mirror and it has a piece of aluminum in the back, and the light in the daytime, the light comes in, bounces off there, and you use the 96% that's reflected off the back to see things. At night, to avoid glare, you tilt it and you use the 4% that bounce off this front surface of the glass. And to keep them from being at the same place, there's a wedge. This surface is not parallel to that one. Okay, so you've seen quantum mechanics in action. Why is this quantum mechanics? Because there's something random and unknowable. When one photon comes up, either it's going to go through and be detected here, or it's going to be reflected and be detected there. Both will not happen, right? It's random. It's not knowable ahead of time which one it is. Of course, if you have millions and billions of these particles coming, then you'll see a steady rate of them here and a steady rate of them here. But if you make a very dim light source, so the photons are coming one at a time, then something random happens. You can't know the result of the experiment before you do it. And the result will vary each time you do the experiment. Sometimes transmitted, sometimes reflected. Well, how does the particle know or decide what to do? That's a problem. In fact, that problem is so bad that Isaac Newton, who was putting forth this corpuscular theory of light, he knew that this was a serious problem. But Feynman has this great footnote in his book. He says, Newton was a great man. You know, he knew that light was made of particles. So even though this problem, he didn't know how to solve this problem, it made no sense, Feynman's saying that he was correct, or it is correct to view these as particles. So there's something very strange that we have to worry about. Newton worried about maybe there were little holes in the glass that opened and closed and sometimes let the particles through, but he thought of lots of arguments why that couldn't be right. So he never was able to resolve that because he didn't know about quantum mechanics. Well, there's some more problems with this classical model. There's something called diffraction. Remember, we talked about having something to cast a shadow, and it just particles are moving in a straight line. Well, now let's consider, instead of a shadow, let's have a big thing that's making a big shadow, and it's got a little tiny slit in it, maybe 1/1,000th of a meter, 1/1,000th of a millimeter in size, very, very small. So if light is just particles that travel in straight lines, then all these particles would just get stopped here, and a very small number that happened to be lined up with the hole would just go through, and they'd all pile up right there. Well, that doesn't happen. What happens instead is that one photon comes in and it might go down there, the next one might go down there, the third one might go up there. It's completely unknowable where the photon is going to land. It's seemingly random. It is random. And this is an example of this so-called uncertainty principle. We know the position, the vertical position of the photon very, very precisely because it went through that little hole. But afterwards, we don't know which direction it's going in. We've lost some information by the act of measuring where it is. We no longer know which direction it's headed in and where it's going to land. We've affected the system by measuring its position. Well, again, it's seemingly random. Particles come through it one at a time, and sometimes they go down, sometimes they go up, sometimes they go here. Very strange. But then there's something even more strange. Suppose you take two of these slits, each a few millionths of a meter in size, separate them by a few, a 100,000th of a meter, 100th of a millimeter, and the particles go through and spread out like this, it doesn't just make two copies of this, it makes so-called interference fringes. The particles still land in random places, but they're more likely to land in certain spots than other spots. And these variations in intensity are called interference fringes. So there's something very strange that happens when these particles have two choices, if you will, of paths. They can come along and go through this slit or through that slit, and it affects the final positions. So that actually was, this interference pattern was what I was showing you before. I told you there was a light bulb and a bunch of neutral density filters, but I didn't tell you there were two little slits. And at first, the particles are just landing at these places. You can't tell how many slits there are, if there's going to be any pattern, just random. If you did the experiment over again, they would land here and here and here, just random. But after a long time, you find out that it's more probable for the particles to land here than here, more probable here than here. So in a statistical sense, if you do the experiment 100 million times, you'll find out that there are more likely places for it to land than other places. If you do the experiment only once, you really can't tell anything. So that's completely non-classical. There's no way that you can explain that in terms of just particles moving in straight lines. Okay, so maybe you don't believe this really happens, so we're going to do a demonstration, which is simple enough for you to do at home. A do-it-yourself two-slit experiment, okay? And it works like this. Get yourself a bathroom mirror, get some baby powder, very expensive equipment, sprinkle it on the mirror, just dust it moderately heavily, maybe shake it off a little bit. Take a flashlight, stand back about this distance, and shine the, put, you know, stand so you can see yourself in the mirror, and then hold the flashlight to the side of your head. You're not going to be able to see it from where you're sitting, so what I've got here is a video camera, which is going to display what you would see if you saw this. Okay, so here's the... Okay, I have to turn this light off. So before we start this demo, I should explain how you know what kind of science lecture you're at. From the demos, if it smells, it's biology. If it explodes, it's chemistry. And if it doesn't work, it's physics. But, okay. So there you can see these interference fringes. You notice that they're colored. Let me get down so the people behind can see. Okay, they're different colors. The light is white, but the reflected light has separated into different colors. And the reason for that, you can put that back on, thanks. And the lights can come back where they were, thanks. The reason for that is that white light is made up of different colors of light, red, green, blue, yellow, and these interference fringes have different spacing. Some are close together, some are further apart, and so the light separates a little bit into different colors. Here's on the web page, in case you try this at home and it doesn't work, that's what it's supposed to look like. I took this picture by just taking a digital camera, which has a flash about an inch to the right of the lens, and went back 10 feet and snapped that picture. That's all you have to do. Or you can just look with your eye with a flashlight. So what's going on? Well, what's happening is you have a mirror consists of a piece of glass, and there's aluminum on the back, which makes it shiny and reflects the light. And we need something like two slits, or a choice of two paths for the particle to take. So the photon leaves the flashlight, hits the dust grain, and then it has two choices. It can bounce back into your eye, or it can reflect off the mirror and then bounce back into your eye. And those two choices are really equivalent to having two sources of light, if you will, the original grain and its mirror image, or equivalently having two slits that you can go through. Okay? So it's a generalization of this two-slit experiment. And so each dust grain and its mirror image act as a pair of slits. So I told you the slits had to be incredibly small distance apart, had to be very tiny. But the nice thing about this is you just take the tiny particles of the baby powder, sprinkle them at completely random locations, and each and every one acts like a coherent two-slit source of this interference effect. So you saw bright and dark patches, which are places. This is the analog in living color of that other picture where you saw the random dots, and there were more here than here, more here than here, and so forth. Okay, well, what would happen if you generalized two slits to half a million slits, each one about a millionth of a meter wide? Well, then you get something called a diffraction grating. Then, unlike an ordinary mirror, remember in an ordinary mirror, the light comes in and it bounces off at the same angle that it came in. At least that's what the classical laws of physics would predict, just like billiard balls. But here, it turns out, if you have blacken little portions of the mirror every millionth of a meter, the light comes in and different colored lights bounce off in different directions, so that you can separate white light into the red part and the blue part and so forth. But where are we going to get something that you can do at home that's cheap, that has a million lines, little black lines per meter, and costs $5? Well, here's one right here. This is the wonders of modern technology. It's just a CD, okay? And almost any kind of CD will work. Although, of course, you shouldn't use any of your box CDs because those are classical. Okay, so here's the experiment. You get a compact fluorescent light bulb, not an incandescent bulb, although it's interesting to compare the two, but a compact fluorescent. And that contains some atoms of different gases, neon and mercury and so forth. And one of the features of quantum mechanics is that the electrons that are orbiting around the nucleus in those atoms can only have certain discrete quantized energy levels, that they will emit particles of light when they fall from one energy, one orbit to the next orbit, that have a certain special energy. And that energy is related to the color of the light, whether it's red, that's a lower energy, blue is a higher energy. And white light is just made up of a whole bunch of different colors from a red through blue. And so this contains a whole mixture of gases, each of which is putting out these different colored lines. And when they bounce off all of these grooves, something non-classical happens. The particles don't all bounce off at the same angle, but they bounce off at angles that depend on what color they are. So, okay, now we have to attempt to set this up. So here's the fluorescent light bulb. I'm going to just take a cardboard box that has a little slit cut in it to make a little source of a line of light. I'm going to look in the dark for the switch. There we go. And now I've got a CD mounted just on a little platform here. I'm just going to park it in front of there and fool around for a minute and see if I can get this to look better than that. It did when we practiced. Remember what I said about demos? Well, you can see it's spread out into different colors. And there's the purple, somehow not quite as spectacular as it was an hour ago when I practiced. Okay. There, okay, you can see the blue, yellow, green, yellow, red, and if you do it correctly, it looks okay. Well, I guess I'm going to show you a picture of what it should look like. Okay, as soon as our photon source returns, okay. So again, that was just taken with a digital camera, and you can see there isn't a continuous band of light of different colors. There's a discrete color of violet, blue, green, yellow, red. It's a little tricky with these pictures because the digital camera can only detect three colors, red, green, blue. So it's the colors are not exactly right in these pictures. But you can see that the white light has been broken up into different colors. And here is the white light coming from the slit that is bouncing off at the same angle that it came in. And over here is light that's coming off at a different angle, different ones for each color. Okay? So again, you can do that very easily at home or in a classroom. There's another picture of a fluorescent lamp. Here's a picture of what an incandescent bulb looks like. It does not produce those discrete lines. It has continuously varying colors because it works in a different way by using a very hot filament. The electrons are shaking back and forth and emitting particles of light of all different energies. So you can see immediately the discreteness of the atomic energy levels in this spectrum. The green is mercury. I think the red is neon, and I don't really know what the others are. Okay. So there are several examples of non-classical effects. So remember, let me just remind you, in the classical picture, light is made of particles. They travel like billiard balls. They bounce off the smooth surface of the mirror at the same angle they came in. And that fails to explain these experiments that we've just seen. These experiments involve a choice of which of the parts of the mirror you bounce off of, or which slit you go through, and something is different. Something quantum mechanical is happening. Let's try to understand what that is in the way that Feynman interpreted it. So Feynman made the following radical suggestion. He said, instead of the particle taking just one particular path from here to your eye or the detector, maybe it takes all possible paths. It might bounce off of this path or this path or this path or this one. And they do not satisfy the classical condition that these angles are equal. They're just all possible paths, in some sense, at the same time. It tests out all these different paths or samples them. That's the mirror experiment. In the two-slit experiment, the photon might have a choice of going through this slit or this slit and going to the detector, and it tries them both. Already that's sounding a little bit insane, right? And it gets worse. But the thing is, Feynman makes this important point that no matter how crazy these ideas sound, if they agree with experiment, then that's the way it is. You have to accept it. Okay, so strange feature number one of quantum mechanics is that each particle takes all possible paths from the source to the detector. And we'll see some more about that in a minute. Now, strange feature number two is that each particle carries with it, in metaphorically, a stopwatch, which is running at a constant rate with its second hand going around like this. And that rate is determined by the color of the light or the frequency of the light. So red light is turning around very slowly, perhaps 10 to the 14 times per second. And blue light is turning around, or ultraviolet light is turning around 10 to the 15 times per second. It's very fast, but it doesn't really matter. So it's going around at some rate. So let's just think about one color of light. Each particle is carrying this little stopwatch, metaphorically speaking. And there's a very crazy rule for how to combine the clock readings from different paths. If you take one path, which is short, the clock will not have advanced very far. If you take another path, which is longer, the clock will have advanced further because it took longer to get there. And there's a rule for combining those clock readings. So let's say on path number one was fairly short, and this is the clock reading. Path number two was a little longer, and the clock reading is here. Path number three, it's even longer, the clock reading is here. And the rule is you should combine these little arrows from the second hand of the watch, putting the base of this one on the tip of the one before, and then finding the length of the arrow that connects you from the beginning to the end. Okay? And then you should take the area of the square whose side is that long. Now, why would you do this rule? Well, that rule, that crazy sounding rule, tells you the probability that the particle will end up at this spot. So you specify the path, the particle goes from here to here, but you only specify the starting and ending points, and then you have to consider all the paths in between and add up all these arrows and then get this square. And the bigger the square is, the more likely it is you'll end up in that spot. And then if you want to see the probability of ending up in another spot, you have to do the whole calculation over again. Well, that sounds very, very strange that the particle is sampling all these different paths, and then you're supposed to combine some property of all those paths, these stopwatch readings, and then that tells you not where the particle landed, but where it's most likely to land. So if it happens, let's say you have two paths, and it happens that the stopwatch readings are parallel like this, then you'll get a big square, and that means you're more likely to land in that spot. So that's this constructive interference, the place where you saw lots of particles landing. That place had the property that the stopwatch readings line up like this. In other places, let's say you look at another position where the particles might land, and the two paths have the property that their stopwatch readings are pointing in opposite directions, then you'll get a very small square. And in that place, Feynman tells you, that's going to be very unlikely to find a particle of light landing there. That's called destructive interference. So let's understand the two-slit experiment now from this point of view. Okay? So here's the source of light. You put the light through a little slit. You don't know which way it's going when it comes out because of diffraction. It might go, because you've measured the position, you no longer know the direction. It might have gone that way, or it might have gone that way. And then it might go here and land at this spot, or it might land here, or it might land there. And so for each place, you have to calculate what's the probability that it's going to land there. Okay? So let's pick this spot right here. You can see lots of particles are landing there, so it must be very probable. And it turns out that because you're right in the center, and both paths have the same length, so path one will give this clock reading, and path two will give that clock reading. The two clock readings will be the same because the length of the path is the same. And so they will add up to give a big square, and there's a high probability of landing in that place. Now let's draw paths that go down to here. Well, one of them will be shorter, and the other one will be longer, okay? And as a result, the two clock readings will no longer be the same. In fact, they'll be opposite. And you'll get almost no area of that square and almost no probability that a particle will land there. And sure enough, when you do the experiment, there are lots of photons detected here and none here. Okay? So this very crazy sounding rule that particles take all possible paths from point A to point B, and that you should add up their stopwatch readings for each path to figure out whether in the end it ended up at that spot or not. That very crazy rule explains all quantum experiments. So it's consistent with these experiments. It quantitatively explains what's going on and has to be true, no matter how crazy it sounds. But you say, well, wait a minute. I mean, this is sounding so crazy that I don't believe it's really true. Okay. Well, I can understand that. How can this idea of particles taking all possible paths be consistent with everyday experience? So, for instance, I know that this idea of geometric optics, that particles just move in straight lines, they bounce off mirrors the way billiard balls do, that works pretty well. That's how you look at yourself in the mirror and so forth. So how can it be that if I had a mirror and a light source here, that in addition to this classical trajectory, the particle is also trying out all these other trajectories, or sampling them and combining the stopwatch readings to tell you the probability that you're here? That just doesn't seem possible. For instance, I know that if I have a 10 centimeter mirror and I just chop off most of it so it's only 1 centimeter, half an inch long, it's still going to basically work, right? And it's still going to bounce light off at the same angle that it came in. I suppose I made it the mirror smaller and smaller, so I'm getting rid of these parts, then nothing seems to be changing. So that means that all of these other paths that Feynman says the particle's taking, they can't seem to make any difference. So let's understand that's actually okay, because when you calculate what the effect of all those other places are, it cancels out. So this is the one difficult point, and I'll try to go. Uh-oh. Kevin, any suggestions? It's all those paths, yes. Well, we can switch. We can switch to the regular overhead. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. When all else fails, shut off the power. Right. So let's review what's going on and understand why Feynman's crazy rule is not inconsistent with your everyday experience, okay? So again, there's this classical trajectory. I'm going to break up the mirror into little sections, A, B, C, etc. And there's one path that comes in and bounces off and goes to your eye where these angles are equal, and that's the one that is predicted classically or by geometric optics. But Feynman says, no, the particle's also bouncing off all parts of the mirror, sampling all possible paths from here to there. Well, let's see what the rule says. So let's take this path. Okay, this is a very long path, right? And there's a certain clock reading that you get from bouncing off part A because it takes a long time. When you bounce off this path, it's slightly shorter, so the time is less. And the clock reading is somewhat different. But the time that it takes for each path is changing rapidly out here as you move along from A, B, to C, to D. And so these guys are tumbling all around in different directions, and A, B, C, D are adding up to give approximately zero. So that's good, because we didn't think the particles were going out there anyway. And then something very special happens near the classical trajectory. The length of time that it takes to go along these paths is a minimum. It's the shortest of all the paths to go here. And the times for the paths that are nearby, because this is a minimum, they're almost the same. And so all these arrows in from the paths that are near the middle are approximately parallel, and they add up to give you a very large contribution. And then all these guys out here, the arrows are tumbling rapidly and add up to essentially zero. So this final arrow that gives you the probability of going to this spot is dominated, the contributions of the clock readings are dominated by paths that are near the classical path. And the ones out here tend to all cancel each other with this destructive interference, so they aren't that important anyway. And that's why you can chop off most of the mirror and it doesn't make any difference. Okay, so this crazy rule is actually consistent with your everyday experience. And the thing you want to understand about this is why it is that the paths that are near the minimum in time all take approximately the same time. And that's due to Feynman's French curve theorem, which is described in his book, Surely You're Joking. He's in Far Rockaway in mechanical drawing class in high school, and they have these French curves. So you young people probably don't know what they are, but they were pieces of plastic with some shape, and you could use them in the days when you made mechanical drawings with pen and ink and paper rather than computers. And the other guys in the class are looking at this, and they don't know why is it that got that shape. And they say, Feynman, why does the French curve have this shape? Is it some special mathematical function or something that you can use to make these curves? And Feynman immediately says, yes, this is a very special curve. It has the property that no matter how you orient it, the tangent at the lowest point is always exactly horizontal. And so they try it, you know. Sure enough, the tangent at the bottom is exactly horizontal. And that means that all these lowest points are approximately the same height, right? So all of these paths near the path that is the shortest all take about the same length of time. So this is called the principle of least time, that the most important paths taken by the particle are ones near where you thought they were. It should go classically. The classical path is the one that takes the least time. So you've seen this all in mirages. You're driving on the highway someplace like Indiana, where I'm from, where it's flat, and the highway heats up from absorbing the sunlight, and it warms the air near the surface of the road. The air becomes less dense, and when air is less dense, there are fewer molecules there, and it turns out that light travels a little slower when there are a lot of air molecules around than when there are fewer. So in cold air, light travels slower than in warm air. So you might think, sitting in your car looking out at the sky, that there will, of course, be light coming directly to your eye. But there's another set of paths which are also quick. Namely, you go a longer distance, but you dip down into the warmer air where you can travel faster, and you get here in a short time. And as the photons come up to your eye like this, you look down and you see blue, and it looks like a lake, right? And it's really the sky, the blue light from the sky. So that is a nice illustration of the principle of least time. Another one is refraction. So you know that if you take this bamboo pole, you go fishing with it, and you dip it down into the surface of the lake, and you look at it, it looks like it bends when it goes through the water, right? And the reason for that is that when light passes through an interface like this, it changes direction. And we can understand that also from the principle of least time, because light travels at a certain speed in the air and a rather slower speed in water because it's much denser than air. Okay? And we want to find the path that takes the least time, either from the fish back to your eye or from a flashlight down to the fish. Let's say from a flashlight down to the fish. So let's look at these different paths. You might say, well, light travels so slowly in water that I want to go over here and then straight down. But that you can actually do slightly better by going to this point. You spend a little bit longer time in the water, but less time in the air. And this is actually the path of least time. This is the path of least distance. You go in a straight line, but you spend too much time in the water going slowly, so it takes longer. And of course, this is a very long time. So the principle of least time tells you that the most probable path taken by the particles is to go like this and then bend and go there. And that explains this refraction effect, which you've all seen. What about lenses? Lenses use the principle of least time to trick the particles in an interesting way. You have a source of light, you have a piece of glass which is thicker in the middle than at the ends, okay? And now there's a certain special spot called the focal point. If you sit there and look at the path that goes straight through, it takes a long time because it goes through the thick part of the glass where the light goes slowly. Here's a much longer path, but it goes through much less glass. And the particle gets there at exactly the same length of time. And so its stopwatch reading is exactly the same, actually, for all of these paths. So there's a special spot called the focal point where the stopwatch readings of the time it takes for the particles to go on all these different paths is exactly the same. And you get a huge probability that the particles will land here and nowhere else. And that's the focal spot. And you've all probably seen that. Probably not going to see this terribly well from the back of the room. But there's a source of light. There's a lens. And you can see the light is covering the whole lens here. And as I move back, it focuses down to a point. And then it gets larger again. Most of you probably can't see that. But I'm sure you've seen that in playing with ordinary lenses. So again, the lens uses this principle of least time. Well, now you say, this is terribly confusing. First you tell me light's a particle, travels in straight lines, it bounces like this at this classical trajectory. And then you say, Feynman says, well, wait a minute, it goes all over the mirror, sampling all possible paths. And then you say, well, that doesn't make sense. I know the light doesn't go over there. And I say, well, it does, but the effect of going over there, the effect of all these paths cancels out because all these arrows just add up to give zero. Well, if the contributions from all these other paths add up to give zero, is the particle really going there? And that's an interesting question. And you can actually show that it is going there. And it's very simple. I'm going to focus now. I'm going to blow up this picture a little bit. And I'm going to focus over here on the left-hand end at the paths that are at the extreme edge of the mirror, which I don't believe are very important anyway. And I'm going to show you they are important, even though they all cancel out. And the way I do that is I imagine the particles can bounce from this point or this point or this point or this point, and I check the clock readings, the stopwatch readings, for each path. And each one of these takes a rather different time because it's over at the edge. It's not in the middle near the extremum of the time, the minimum time, where the French curve theorem tells you that all the arrows are going to be parallel. They're all in different directions, and they're all adding up to give zero. So the particle, maybe it's not going there at all. But we can find out. Let's take some black paint and just every millionth of a meter or so, let's take the shiny part and make it black. So that, and we'll pick the regions to black out where all the arrows are pointing slightly to the left. And I'll just get rid of those. Okay? So now I'm getting contributions only from paths where the arrows are at least pointing slightly to the right, and they will all add up to give me a big contribution. Okay? So if I include all parts of the mirror over here, it cancels out and gives me zero. But if I get rid of little bits of the mirror, I suddenly get a big contribution from parts of the mirror that I thought were unimportant. So the particles must be going over there. And that, in fact, explains the diffraction grating with this, the CD that I showed you. That the light goes down, hits all, takes all possible paths, bounces off all parts of the CD, but the way the CD works, there are little grooves in it, a millionth of a meter apart, and there's a shiny bit in between, and it there are special directions where, for blue light, where the clock is running at a certain rate, that you get constructive interference. You get the arrows adding up from all these places if you sit here and only there. But for red light, you have to sit over here. So the light comes off in different directions, non-classical effect, different directions depending on its color, and that's how you saw that those different colors of the atomic lines. So the main message then is that in quantum mechanics, when particles can have two paths that lead to the same final state, say through this slit or through that slit, you can get interference effects which cause it to be more probable or less probable to end up at that particular spot depending on these stopwatch readings. So that's very different from classical mechanics, and the first time I gave this talk was in Sweden, so I explained that quantum mechanics is very different from classical mechanics, just as Danes are very different from Norwegians. Of course, if I had given the talk in Norway, it would be different. Well, you might ask, well, what is the difference between Danes and Norwegians? And I will explain. So that's the difference between Danes and Norwegians. And the message I want to leave you that Feynman is telling us about quantum mechanics is when it comes to quantum mechanics, you should think different. Okay, thank you very much. In case you want that. I think this will also end up on the ITP webpage, or you can write this down.
Yeah, it will end up on our website. Steve is ready to answer all questions.
And we'd appreciate it if you would use this microphone, but don't be shy. Okay, Paris, do you want to hand it out? I think there's a question here.
As I understand it, the photons are discrete.
Yes.
And with the little mirrors, the way you divided them up, it looked like they were spatially discrete. And then when you corresponded that with time, the little clock readings, in other words, you were able to get to a point where you didn't have to divide them up anymore for them.
Okay.
Not to cancel out.
Board and I'll use the.
So I'm wondering if you're saying that time comes in discrete.
Okay, so that's a good question. The question is, I seem to be dividing the mirror up into discrete segments and talking about this time or that time or that time.
Well, the arrows of time, the clock times.
Right. So if I take this path, I get a certain clock reading. If I take that path, I get a different clock reading. So that's actually just an approximation. I really should consider this path and this path and this path, all the paths is kind of a continuum. There's an infinite number of them. And to make life simple, I just made an approximation where I said basically the particles that bounce off of this segment have about one clock reading, and the, off this segment have a slightly different clock reading. I just made a discrete approximation. Does that make sense?
Well, then why don't you get this, the same light effects that you would get if you didn't divide the thing up?
Oh, okay, so the diffraction grating works by blackening this segment and getting rid of it altogether, and then keeping this one and getting rid of that one. But if I keep all of them, then I'm getting the arrows from this part will tend to cancel the arrows from this part. So I'm removing, I'm selectively removing those paths which give arrows pointing back to the left and keeping the ones that give arrows pointing to the right.
Well, if it's infinitely divisible, wouldn't you get arrows that point the other way within A?
No, because I've taken this to be so small that no matter exactly where I land in A, the arrows are all about the same. I can go into more detail later if you want.
Light moves at a finite velocity. Sorry.
A path that's considerably longer, like it would have to go all the way over here before the arrow would have turned all the way around. All of these paths give arrows that are about the same because they take about the same length of time. Okay. Well, we can try again after the talk.
This argument is presented for
The microphone is up here. We'll get to you in a moment.
Do you know if Feynman actually used this simply as a mathematical convenience, or whether he actually attributed any kind of physical interpretation to the rotating stop?
Okay, so the question is this some mathematical rule that happens to work, or does it have some physical meaning? And for those people that think light is made of waves, and there's a whole other formulation of quantum mechanics in which light is made of waves, and it's easy to understand these effects and very hard to understand why you get those little dots on the digital camera from discrete lumps of energy. You have to pay a price somewhere. In every picture works well in certain places and makes no sense in other places. Let's just ask, so the thing that the stopwatch reading is, if you believe in waves, it's just the frequency of the wave, okay? But let's ask a closely related question, which is, what is the physical reality of these paths? Is the particle really taking those paths and then using this stopwatch rule? And the interesting thing is that any experiment that you do to find out which path the particle took will destroy this interference effect. So for instance, if you have two slits and you have this path and that path, and you get this interference pattern where there's lots of particles landing here and here and none in between, if you put a little detector here, quite precisely what it does is randomly reset the clock for each particle that goes through. And that destroys this interference pattern. That's precisely what it does. If you know which path it took, then you have destroyed this effect. So we can't say, did it take both paths? Did it do it simultaneously? That has no meaning, because as soon as we try to find out, the effect is ruined. But there's this crazy rule that says, pretend it takes all the paths, do the stopwatches, and it agrees with the experiment. And no matter how much you don't like it, the fact that it agrees with experiment forces us to accept it. But that's the kind of question that really bothers people that do quantum mechanics, even today, 70 years after its invention. But that's the way it is. Okay, can we?
It seems to me that I remember that Feynman said that one electron was all that was needed for this universe. And I was wondering if it came along with this idea that it's taking all these different paths, so why not every path, everywhere, mm-hmm. every time?
Yes. Actually, the way I heard the story at Princeton was that Feynman was in the graduate college, sound asleep, and his thesis advisor, Johnny Wheeler, called him up in the middle of the night and said, you know, there's only one electron in the universe, and that explains all these things. So the idea is something like this. Here's time, okay? And here's some position, and here's now, okay? And a little while tomorrow, now will be up here, and the day after tomorrow, now will be up here, okay? And imagine there's one electron in the universe, and it can go forward in time and backward in time. So it can do this, and then turn around and go backwards, and then go like that. And the interpretation that you make for why all electrons in the universe have the same charge, they're all identical, they have the same properties, this is only one of them. And you're going along, here's now, and you see right now there's one particle at that place in this position. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, there comes another electron and one moving backward in time, and we call that the antiparticle or the positron. It has the opposite charge. It's positively charged. This is negatively charged. So you didn't create any charge out of nowhere. But now there's three particles in the universe. And then later on, one of them disappears, and there's one again. And really, if you look in this picture, there's sort of just one. But you have to allow it to move forward and backward in time. So it depends on which impossible thing you want to believe before breakfast. But it's, he invented this many paths picture of quantum mechanics in order to solve this problem of how electrons interact with photons. And he needed to do strange things like that to make it agree with experiments. Microphone's coming.
I hope you don't mind the practical question, but this is also a lay member of the audience.
Sure.
And it intrigued me when you mentioned there was a difference between the incandescent and the compact fluorescent, because
yes.
I just put in a new compact fluorescent bulb, and it interferes with my AM radio reception, but it doesn't interfere with the FM. And the old compact neon didn't do anything. So
yeah.
I'm just wondering, what's happening?
Yeah, these compact bulbs have to see, it takes a second to turn on, right? And they have inside them, I think, I am a theorist and I'm not absolutely sure what's inside there, but I think they have inside them a little thing that makes very high frequency oscillations of the voltage, which are necessary to excite the electrons in the atoms up to a higher energy state so they can fall down and emit the light. And if you have something faulty with that, it can interfere with your radio. But don't quote me on that, because I'm not sure it's right.
Do I take it back to Home Depot, or do I?
Take it back, yes. You have my word on it. That's right.
So, is this sort of like a Fermat?
Yes, that's. Yeah, that's a very good point. So, this same guy, Fermat's Last Theorem, you know, the mathematician, he thought deeply about this principle of least time. It was known even actually to the ancient Greeks that it seemed that light took the paths that took the least time. And it's very important that whatever theory you make up for a rule for quantum mechanics about how you take these different paths, it had better be closely consistent with the classical rule of least time. And Feynman shows us why that is, that even though you take all possible paths, the ones that are very close to the path of least time are the most important. They add up to the most of the arrows are parallel and give you the biggest thing. And if that weren't true, then it would, you know, it would be completely inconsistent with our everyday experience. And so it's a kind of this particular formulation of quantum mechanics is the best one for understanding how it's like classical but slightly different. And it is precisely a kind of generalization of Fermat's principle of least time. Namely, you take not only the path of least time, but the ones nearby as well are also important. That's a good point.
I have a question about the diffraction grating, where we couldn't check where the photons were coming in. But in the beginning of the talk, you said if we could have only one photon.
Yes.
What happens to the diffraction pattern with if we only let one photon in?
Okay. So if I have, I showed you a diffraction grating has many, many slits, but I showed you an example with just two slits, and it's really essentially the same. Let me dig this up again. If you send in one photon, it's going to, okay. No, it's all right. If you remember that were, oh, that's okay. I'll draw it, David. Because we, that's, oh, okay. All right. Okay. Right. Real data. That's, I'm surprised to hear you say that, David, as a string theorist. Okay. Okay, I'll draw it over here. So you remember we had this camera, and if we sent just one photon and it just landed someplace, say right there. If I let three in, they just land someplace. If I do the experiment over again, they'll land in different places. So I have no way in doing an experiment where I just let in one particle. It's doing all this stuff that I said. It's trying all the paths, and it's choosing, you know, it's deciding on the probability that it will land in different places. But if you've only done the experiment once, you can't see that pattern. You have to do it many, many times, and then you see, aha, it tends to go to this place more often than that. And if I had many slits with the diffraction grating, what happens is instead of having many places where it goes, there's one place where the red light goes and there's one place where the blue light goes. And all these other intermediate ones are gone. But you can't see, you can't tell that you had a diffraction grating instead of a mirror, really, unless, or at least a two-slit experiment, and you can't do that unless you do the experiment many, many times. So that's one of the statistical or random features of quantum mechanics, that you, because the light comes in discrete lumps, and because you're not exactly sure where each particle is going to land, you can't see any pattern until you do the experiment many, many times.
So how is a red photon different than a blue photon then?
So red photons and blue photons are the same, except that their clocks run at different speeds.
Are they spinning or something?
Yeah, well, okay, so it's a metaphorical clock. I mean, there's this rule that you should pretend there's a clock, you know, get this arrow, add them up a certain way. And there's no physical clock attached to them, but this is the rule. And the rule says that for red light, you should make the clock spin faster, slower, and blue light, it should spin faster if you want to get a result that agrees with the experiment. And that's the rule. There's no why.
Feynman's book, he explains about the energy of photons. Well, blue one has more energy than
yes.
A red one, for example. Can you explain how that relates to the clock?
Yeah, so when the blue light has its clock going faster, it has a higher frequency, if you will. And in quantum mechanics, it turns out that the energy, the quantum of energy that's carried, this lump of energy that's carried, is proportional to how fast this clock is spinning.
So that's really what it is. It has to do with the energy.
It's a measure of the energy. That's right. It turns out that, like, if you have a baseball or an electron, When they go faster, they have more energy. But all particles of light travel at the same speed, but they have different colors or different frequencies of this. Even though they're going at the same speed, they have different energies. And the rate at which the clock is going around is just a measure of that energy. That's not an explanation. That's just a statement that that's how you interpret it. Again, there's no, well, it's not really a why, but...
Can you comment on the experiment that was done, I believe, a couple of years ago in I think Switzerland, where the photon was split and the pair knew which way to turn when they were 7 kilometers apart?
Yes, this, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but this is one of these experiments in quantum information, which quantum mechanics can be used in principle, we don't know yet in practice, to make computers that run extremely fast, to make communication channels which are absolutely secure, because if there's an eavesdropper, traditionally named Eve in all the technical papers, and Eve makes a measurement of what's going down the optical fiber, it ruins the quantum state and the people talking can immediately tell there's somebody there. And there was an experiment done in Geneva in which there's something called entanglement, where you make a quantum state involving two photons that has some very peculiar properties which I won't attempt to explain. And this property of entanglement, that if is completely non-classical, it means that there's certain results of certain experiments will come out very strangely because it's quantum mechanical, and you're able to transfer this pair over a huge distance of several miles and preserve this quantum property, which I haven't explained. But it's a test of your ability to do this perfectly secure communication. If someone had listened in on that fiber, had tapped in, detected one of the particles going by, and then made an exact copy of that particle and put it back in, the receiver would have known that something had happened. You cannot, a quantum measurement perturbs the system in a random way that you can't control, and the presence of the eavesdropper would be known. And this experiment was sort of the first baby step in that direction.
That's very much like measuring the position of the photon.
Exactly. If you measure which slit you go through, it ruins this pattern.
Didn't Feynman make an exception about polarized light, that this rule didn't work with polarized light?
Okay, so the question is, one of the things that Feynman makes a big point about is that in this story that he, you know, he's obviously simplified somewhat. We haven't cheated any. This is really how things work. This crazy rule is really how it is. There are some technical things about how we add up this infinite number of paths by mathematical tricks and stuff. But this is really how it is. But there is one thing that I have left out, and that's polarization. That photons come in two varieties with their electric field oscillating this way or that way. They're sort of two flavors. And they are independent. They're just two kinds of particles. But all of the... So you sometimes hear the statement that the two polarizations can't interfere with each other. But that's not... The point is that I'm doing all these experiments one photon at a time. It really doesn't matter what its polarization is. I'm just giving it two choices, going through this slit or that slit. And those two choices are what cause the interference pattern. So this business with the polarization there's two flavors of photons, but it really doesn't matter for these purposes. Nothing has changed by that existence of polarization. So if you have polarized glasses, they're vertically, they let through photons which are vertically polarized because the glare from the highway tends to be horizontally polarized. That's how they work. So you can make a filter which will pass one polarization and not the other.
When you make the measurements at one slit.
Yeah.
Does it effectively randomize the position of the stopwatch?
Yes.
Or standardize it?
No, it randomizes it because, I don't want to go into why exactly, but if you have two slits and you go through one and you have a little detector that says, okay, it went through this one, or you have a detector here and says, oh, it went through that one, then there is a way of viewing what the effect of the observer or the environment is that it randomly and uncontrollably resets the stopwatch. And it's different each time you do the experiment, and that's what wipes out the interference pattern, because the pattern is a property of doing the experiment over and over millions of times. It's not a property of just doing it once. And if you're randomly resetting this clock on one arm, then it wipes this out. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we should thank Steve again, and you can...